What's the vice of acedia? And why is it something most of us need to fight? How is it both apathetic and frenzied? And how do we overcome it? Join us today as we explore those questions and more with Dr. Brandon Dom, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Franciscan University in Steubenville. I'm Father Dave Pabanka. I'm President of Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. And you're watching Franciscan University Presents. Stay with us. Welcome to Franciscan University Presents. I'm your host, Father Dave Pabanka, and I'm president of Franciscan University of Steubenville. Today we're discussing the vice of acedia, which you may know is similar to sloth. I'm here with our panelists, Dr. Regis Martin, professor of systematic theology at Franciscan University, and Dr. Scott Hahn, the Father Michael Scanlon, professor of biblical theology and new evangelization. I mess it up sometimes, Scott, but we've been here before. We're pleased to welcome our guest and our colleague, Dr. Brandon Dom. He's the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Franciscan University. Dr. Dom is the author of many articles, including Correcting Acedia Through Wonder and Gratitude, which serves as a foundation of our discussion today, of which we should probably get one thing settled very beginning.
Yeah.
Google says acedia. I always learned it Acadia. You are the expert, so let's get this
settled. Is one of the words where I think you pick your translation, you say it confidently.
I pronounce it Acadia.
That's okay.
I do too.
That's okay. Yeah.
That's right.
We're very inclusive.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Why this article? What was moving in you that said, okay, this is something you want to spend time? The article's fantastic.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course.
I learned about the deadly vices tradition in grad school, and I had been interested in virtue, learning about the virtue tradition. But once I learned about the deadly vices tradition, that was really something I understood. There's so much insight and depth to it. And so when I started teaching ethics, I thought I'll teach about Acadia because it was a fascinating vice that I didn't know much about before. I just thought of it as sloth. And I just paired it things I had read your first semester of teaching, I paired it with Bob Roberts' stuff on gratitude, and then Chesterton. And as I taught it semester after semester, I saw this line of thought through it. Hopefully it's a line of thought that's actually there, where these things actually really are helpful in correcting in a way that isn't already in the tradition. Yeah. And that's why. Yeah.
Okay, you do a beautiful job. The definition that you actually use is it's not just laziness, it's not just sloth. So maybe just unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, so we think of it as sloth, and if you've seen any popular productions of it, it's just sloth, it's laziness, it's the couch potato. But it's a lot deeper than that, and unfortunately, it can be kind of everything. Mm. The most simple, straightforward, helpful definition for me is that Acadia is the resistance to the demands of love.
Yeah. I liked that. Yeah. I mean, Roberts, I think it was. It was the woman.
It was Rebecca De Young.
Yes.
It's fabulous. It's not what Aquinas says, but it's an insight that's underneath Aquinas. And
exactly.
I think it makes it more straightforward.
Yeah. So Acadia, A-C-E-D-I-A, for those who haven't read the article or haven't studied the virtues, you know, this is one of the most subtle and yet pervasive vices.
Yes.
A vice is the opposite of virtue. Virtue is a spiritual, ethical strength. I like to describe the virtues as moral muscles for the soul. Mm-hmm. But acedia is not reducible to sloth, but I think it's related to what most people might describe as burnout.
Yeah.
That's just one expression, one symptom of it. Mm-hmm. But it's not just like, I don't want to work. In a certain sense, you point out that I'm working too much without any leisure, without any real peace. Right. Much less gratitude.
Yeah. You can be incredibly busy and still in the grip of...
Yeah, the workaholic can be suffering from acadia just as much as the couch potato.
What's the definition you use, though, of being attentive to what's in front of you or to what you're called to do?
Yeah, think of this. This is arising. So the deadly vices come about from this desert monk. So a bunch of people were living in Alexandria and didn't like the city life, wanted to be holy, and so went out to this fairly dangerous desert life. Mm-hmm. And the first list of the vices comes from Evagrius just observing the brothers. It's not some big theory, it's just observed patterns of rightness and wrongness.
I live with the brothers.
So you probably so maybe you have your own list. But this is Evagrius's list. And it's each, so the desert monks, their life was very structured. There wasn't free time. And so each moment had a calling, and Acadia is this resistance to the calling. You either resist it by doing nothing. This is the couch potato, or you resist it by doing other things.
Right.
Some of them noble, like visiting the poor, checking on your brothers, but those things are in service of avoiding the thing you should be doing.
Yeah. And it was called the noonday deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can pervade your entire life.
That's right.
And then it becomes an invitation to despair. And before you know it, you're slitting your throat.
Yeah.
And maybe your neighbors.
Right.
You know, you get to the heart of it. That is resistance to the demands of love.
Yeah.
Right. And Aquinas, among others, points out, you know, that law and virtue is not in any way opposed to love.
Right.
I mean, we reduce love to an emotion, but Jesus elevated love to the greatest of the 613 commandments.
Yeah.
Quoting Deuteronomy 6:5, you don't think that love can be legislated, but if the lawgiver is love, then it has to be legislated, and it's the only thing that explains the other 612 laws, you know. Yeah. But there's a sense of resentment after a time where you've been taking effort, making great effort to grow in virtue, and you're like, it's just not worth it. You know, it's just too demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the virtues, it's love itself. And the way that you express this is something I believe most of us can relate to, you know, especially if we're out in the work world. You know, mm-hmm. I can imagine monks who are just daily spiritual exercise. And, you know, every minute is scheduled, but so on the schedule, you'll find leisure. You're going to find rest. You're going to find, I suspect, times of
fellowship.
Prayer.
Yeah,
and fellowship, right. And so if it's true in the desert for the monks who are like, you know, major league players, then people who are trying to raise the kids and tend the house and hold down a part-time or full-time job, and it's like, whoa.
This is
going to be less common, but more.
So I think everyone sympathizes with the laziness, with the undiscipline. But when you see what's underneath it, I mean, when I teach this, my students immediately get it, and then they see things. I mean, I give them the example of, why is your room clean during finals time? Because they're avoiding doing their work. They're avoiding studying, and there's this other productive thing to do. I mean, I did this on Monday. I cleaned my office instead of doing the reading I was supposed to do.
Yeah, I did the laundry when I was supposed to be writing my dissertation.
Yeah, that's right.
More than the rest of my married life.
I like Aquinas's formulation. I really do. Sadness in the face of a spiritual good.
Yeah.
I mean, God offers us salvation, and it's as if we're telling God, is that all there is? Can't you offer me something more delectable? This leaves me weary, unsatisfied.
Right.
But that is sloth. And if you're in the grip of it, it can easily turn into something damnable.
Yeah.
You don't want salvation. You don't want joy.
No, that's right. The very classic formulation description of this that Cassian borrows from Evagrius is this really powerful description of the downward fall of a monk. The desert personified the vices, literally, in that they thought they were demons sometimes, but also that each vice has its own kind of character. It's trying to persuade you. It's trying to bring you down a path. And that path is destruction eventually. And so the monk who doesn't want to pray right now, who might go visit his brothers, eventually starts not liking his monastery, that there's greener grass at the other monastery.
There are gradations.
That's right. And it builds. Yeah.
Right. You make a useful distinction between, or maybe one of the authors you cite does that, between situational depression and existential depression. If it's the latter, then that's a serious malady, and you might need counseling or grace.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed that, okay, vices are associated with demons, and this is the noonday devil. But that doesn't strike me as being all that far-fetched. You know, I remember when I was first learning the Catholic faith, before I had entered the church, I'm reading St. Paul, obviously, principalities and powers and that sort of thing. And then you pick up on Dionysius and then Gregory the Great, and there's this nine choirs of angels. I mean, there are slight variations when you compare Gregory with, you know, Dionysius. But at the same time, I was surprised to see the virtues in the hierarchy of angels.
Yeah.
Well, if they're there, you can imagine that in the lowerarchy, there are going to be vices.
Yeah.
So this idea that you are fighting spiritual warfare and you need the Holy Spirit, the sacraments, the brothers in the monastery and that sort of thing, that is not far-fetched at all. That's hard-headed realism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think what the desert does really well is they talk about them as evil thoughts, as passions, as vices, and as demons.
Right.
And I don't think we don't want to discard the demon part is like those old people in the desert didn't understand how things really worked. But I also don't think we want to externalize all of it, because some of it is our own dispositions convincing us and driving us further.
The devil made me do it.
And also it gets too much credit.
The danger of ultra supernaturalism is that you leave out the order of nature altogether. Maybe the guy is just clinically depressed and he needs medication. Okay.
But I think that one of the things you did really beautifully is this continuum that, in my world, that you can kind of honor the person who's going out and feeding the poor, but that in fact may not be what the Lord is calling him to do at that time. So sometimes it's hard to kind of nail down. How do you see that? How do you come to clarity about what's really going on here?
Yeah, I mean, for the monks, it was simple. They had a rigorous and almost exhaustive way of life, and so they knew at each moment what they were supposed to be doing, whether it was praying or manual labor or whatever. For us, it's a lot harder.
Right.
I have 10 things I could do right now. They would all be good things to do. And it isn't that the time is set. It's that at some point I have to get them done. And so Acadia is really difficult for us. I see it in our students, where there's these higher goods we care about. Our students care about their vocation, about discerning.
It's good to pray, but they should also study.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I just think that's hard. Yeah. It's good for me to spend extra time prepping for my classes. Researching, it's also good for me to play with my kids.
Yeah.
You know, I think of two passages in the gospel that sort of find the back door into this. On the one hand, Jesus says, you know, that there will be many who say, Lord, Lord, did we not do many mighty works in your name? Depart from me, I never knew you. I mean, double yikes. On the other hand, you have this parable where, you know, the three are given 5 talents, 2, and then 1. Each according to his ability, it says. And there's nothing to say that this was done privately. So the guy who gets 5 is witnessed by the guy who gets 2 and the guy who gets 1. I mean, he is very diligent in the sense of going out and digging a hole to bury the talent. Right. You know, he is laboring. But it seems to me that there's a sense of resentment. And that is tied to envy. And that is one of the 7 deadly sins. And in Pieper's treatment in Leisure, the Basis of Culture, I believe it is, he speaks of Acadia as a species or as an expression of envy. And that doesn't necessarily clarify things, because we confuse envy with jealousy.
Right.
Whereas jealousy can be good. God is jealous for what is his. But jealousy is usually bad. But envy is only and always evil.
Right.
It's the sadness at another person's blessing.
Right.
You know? And at that point, you get a sense that Acadia is one way that envy masks itself. And just, you know, it can be sloth in the conventional sense. It can be workaholism as well. But it's never, ever expressing gratitude.
Right.
And that, to me, is the bottom line. You know, where you speak of wonder and gratitude, that is what makes up the kingdom. You must become like a child. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing to be offered something and then to wish you hadn't, and that can become sloth and it can be sinful, culpable. But when you visit that upon someone else and you really resent them, then it is envy, and I think that's far more grave.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sloth is just about me. I don't really want this. It makes me tired.
Well, in the description of the monk, what the monk does is eventually he starts wanting to bring people around him. Not only is he dissatisfied with his life, with his calling, he wants others to be dissatisfied with theirs.
He resents the brothers. He also resents the effort needed to become truly.
Yeah.
Then he becomes a menace.
That's right.
Yeah, others. Exactly.
Right.
The noonday devil.
Yeah. Envy and Acadia have this in common in the vices, is that they see goods as evils. A lot of the others see evils as goods.
Right.
But Acadia sees the divine good within, the love we're called to, as an evil.
Right.
And envy sees the good of another as an evil.
It's important, I think, to make certain that it's not superficial or sort of episodic. I think of Winston Churchill. He suffered from what he called the black dog, which periodically would take hold of him.
Right.
But he was able to assuage it by cigars and champagne and, of course, killing Hitler, you know, fighting the Nazis. But it never became a dog that was barking all the time.
Right.
When it becomes that, then you're in serious trouble.
Yeah, I think we see that when we're supposed to be working and we're diverting ourselves and resting, and then when we have time to rest and we start working, whatever the thing is that's to be done is the thing we're not doing.
Do you think, you talk a little bit, does our culture particularly, is it more difficult? Do you see things that So we have to experience.
I mean, there are. So I'm not very good at these generalized societal things. Yeah. So maybe you all have more thoughts. I think our little magic rectangles in our pockets make both directions really easy. I can always find things to do. I can always be working. I also can always be resting not real rest, but you know, watching something or distracting myself. Yeah. But looking at the monks,
anybody can find a distraction. We have a really convenient means in each
direction, but they found their way. Yeah. They would poke their head out of their cell just to see if any other brothers were nearby. Right. And that was always available. Yeah. And so I think there are special versions that we have to deal with, but so the monks had their own special versions.
Right. Yeah. And we have much more to discuss, so please stay with us on Franciscan University Presents.
Let's hear from other voices at Franciscan University of Steubenville.
I cultivate wonder in my life by trying to give all to my work, because work is fundamentally your prayer. And since you pray with the best of your abilities, you should work to the best of your abilities.
Have you ever felt a growing sense of hope in a new day? Like when the dawn light breaks and the world wakes up. We feel that every day because we know that light changes everything. It opens our eyes to possibilities and it propels us forward. Light shows us where we belong. Light is what the world desperately needs. Be light at Franciscan University.
I personally like to try different forms of prayer because doing the same form of prayer over and over again just doesn't work for me. It tends to put me in a sort of rhythm. And so trying different forms of prayer and really getting the most out of them, I'm able to really see the beauty that each of them individually has and to grow in my knowledge of the different kinds of prayer that the Catholic faith has to offer.
Welcome back to Franciscan University Presents. We're learning more about the vice of Acadia, and now we're going to talk about the relationship between vice and virtue and how it allows us to see and what it causes us to see.
So a lot of the advice for growing in virtue is the way you grow in virtue is by habituation. If you want to be patient, do patient things. And that's great advice. It's helpful, but it is a little sort of just put in the willpower and you'll get there and do it over and over. Yeah. And
it makes it a lot me. I have to do this.
Yeah, and it's just sort of effort. Yeah. And that's true. I mean, growing in virtue is difficult. But I like shortcuts or other ways in. Mm-hmm. And one sort of window into this, I think, is the insight from the tradition, this is all through the tradition, is that virtues and vices affect how we see things. They change the way that you view the world. The kind person sees someone suffering, they experience that differently, what they perceive in the situation is different mm-hmm. than the cruel person. Mm-hmm. And so what I've tried to do is explain a way that virtues affect sight, and that is that virtues and vices are emotion-generating things. The just person, the kind person, they have different sets of emotions that characteristically arise. Yeah. And that emotions, on the view I describe in the article that I won't go deep into, are ways of seeing the world. And so just a brief example that I think shows this. So let's say you're invited to someone's house for dinner, a very important person.
Great story.
To not use anyone in particular, let's call him Vincent Allen. Vincent Allen invites my family over for dinner. And we go there and he has this priceless family heirloom that's a ceramic vase. And we're having dinner, we're having a nice time, my kids are playing, and one of my kids, we'll blame Lucy, she's the youngest, we hear a shattering in the other room, and we run into the room. And my wife, Vincent Allen, and I see Lucy sitting with a broken vase all around her. Now my wife, a very good mother, sees this, and she feels fear. Because what stands out to her, what she sees in the situation, is the dangerous ceramic shards around her daughter.
Right.
Because I'm not as good of a parent, and I'm vainer, I feel embarrassment because I'm worried about how this important person is going to view me now.
Right.
So I see what's embarrassing, that my daughter has done something to make me look bad. And Vincent sees the offense of us not watching our daughter and the broken, priceless heirloom, and he feels anger. These three emotions aren't just felt things inside. They're actually ways of perceiving what's going on.
Yeah.
And virtues and vices give rise to these kinds of patterns.
Yeah.
And so Acadia makes us see things as empty, as boring, as hollow, not something to grab onto, not something that holds us.
That's fascinating, the visual faculty.
Yeah.
I mean, the eye is the point of entry into the soul. And if it's concealed or impeded by something else, you don't see what is there. Maybe in the context of the post-COVID world, we can understand this, because what that madness of masking prevented people from really seeing the other. So you can't really work up much empathy for someone you never see. They're just a silhouette. Is that possible? Is that why the grip of sloth is so tight for so many? I mean, I sense it in my students.
Yeah.
They're coming out of this COVID coffin, and it's hard to sort of jumpstart their passion.
Yeah, I mean, the years that they spent not being around people, doing their education online, it has lots of wild effects. I think there's probably a way that Acadia attaches to that, but. I mean, I've been trying to write and read for a long time now, and I still feel it in myself very much that it's, and I got to see my colleagues and my neighbors a lot. So I think there's probably sort of like last time, there's something special about it that because Acadia will use whatever it can.
Right. It'll attach itself
and
warp it and massage it.
Yeah.
You know, you spoke of the madness of masking. You know, I think of an ironic reversal applying here, because there is a sort of masking of madness and other emotions that we sort of cover over, so that instead of tracing uncomfortable emotions back to the vices or the lack of virtue, we're just kind of treating the symptoms with Advil or whatever, you know, and not really dealing with the source of the swelling. Whereas your construal, a word you use, of the vices and the virtues, I think, is something that has to be retrieved, not just in terms of virtue theory, but virtue acquisition.
Yeah.
Through doing the good habitually, having those habits inhabit our soul. You know, I love the analogy between the hundreds of muscles in our body that are grouped under the four muscle groups. And the hundreds of virtues that we practice or strive for that are grouped under the four cardinal virtues, you know. And that way you can see, you know, on the one hand, just because you're really virtuous in one area, you might be really muscle bound in one area. You know, your biceps might be oversized, as it were. And so, you know, all of this comes back from emotion to virtue and vice. But I think it also comes back to mentoring, to having a model, to having parents, because so much more is mimesis. It is so much, it's so much more easily caught than taught.
Yeah.
And so you're imitating your father figure, your mother, mother figures, pastors, professors, all of these people. And yet even the monks must have found out that their masters were virtuous, but they had limits, they had vices too. So, I mean, this is going to sound pietistic, but I think it's precisely right. It comes back to Jesus. It is the imitation of Christ. And imitate me as I imitate Christ, Paul would say, but don't imitate me when I fall short.
Right.
And I think that's what people are starving for in this world. Real servant leaders who live out the virtues in a way that you don't have an x-ray. Look at all of those muscles or whatever.
Right.
You just have this integration.
And I think what that does is it provides us a little bit more clarity. We hear a lot about virtue-based education, but grounded and rooted in what? And I think that the faith, we'll talk more about that because I think it's important. You spend some time about starving. You use this image of starving the vice. I mean, how does that happen?
So virtues and vices, to be built, need their activities. So the way you grow in a certain virtue is you have that kind of virtuous activity. But one of the activities is its characteristic emotional expression. And if I'm right about emotions are ways of seeing the world, then it's the virtue and vice need its sort of way of experiencing, its way of seeing things. And so if we can starve one of the vices, and what I mean by that is keep ourselves from seeing the world the way it needs to be seen,
it
keeps the vice from the nourishment it needs, and it will slowly diminish.
If the tug of your emotional life is in the direction of, say, a kind of ennui, boredom, a dissatisfaction with life, then you have to just fake it until you make it?
So unfortunately, emotions aren't the kinds of things we can just choose to have as we want. But we do have some control over practicing the ways the emotions make us see the world. And so, I mean, I talk about gratitude a lot in the paper. And so the grateful person sees things as a good gift. And even if you don't see the thing as good, you're actually not experiencing it as good, you can reflect and see that you should experience it as good. And you know it's good in some way, even though you can't feel it.
Right.
And that's a little bit of resistance to what sloth wants. Yeah.
You also speak in the article of this nexus, this connection. I mean, it's classical that you give into gluttony, and then that's going to fuel lust,
right. And
that's going to fuel greed. Yeah. And, you know, I'm looking at that just like I'm looking at myself throughout the entire article.
Right.
You know? And I'm realizing, you know, starving really has to take place in terms of fasting.
Right.
You know, not just temperance in eating. But, you know, it's one thing to master the appetites. It's another thing to mortify in the proper way, at
right.
the proper time. And I see so many things under the surface of our treatment of virtue and vice that, I mean, here at Franciscan, we're spoiled by great homilies. But even the great homilists don't always touch upon these things. And a homily just isn't enough time. I mean, this program isn't enough
time. We could preach longer if you'd like.
I wish I had made that connection to the literal starvation. That's a great insight that I hadn't thought of. So fasting is starving, like literally starving gluttony, to help build in the right dispositions, the right attitudes, the right desires towards food. Because Acadia isn't after literal food intake, it's after a certain avoidance of the good,
right.
And to see that because it sees that good as harmful, as a struggle, as difficult, what I'm arguing for is practicing ways of forcing ourselves to see that as good, if just for a little bit,
right.
Finding patterned ways to day to day see these things as good that are good, and to fight Acadia that way.
I don't want this to take a confessional turn, but I suspect that this is a vice that you wrestle with, right?
Yes.
And I was struck by the citation in the bibliography to an essay by Evelyn Waugh, who was one of my heroes.
Yeah.
In 1962, he wrote a piece on sloth.
Right.
And he struggled with it. Mm-hmm. It was the great combat of his life. He could never look at his watch without being disappointed that it wasn't later than it already was. And that was the occupational hazard of the monk in the desert. You know, what time is it? When will this be over? How many more prayers do I have to send up to God?
Well, if you're interested in why, I cite an essay by Heather Hughes Huff, where she's talking about the Sword of Honor trilogy and about how there's insights about Acadia through there.
Back.
And it's her essay is fantastic. Yeah.
His characteristic vice.
Yeah. What are the hours? I don't want to distract here, but you know, between the fourth and the eighth hours, I think it was Cashin who speaks of that as the trial period for the
months.
What time of day is that?
Every time I teach this, I have to make sure I look it up to get it right. But it's roughly, it's from lunch to the mid-evening. So it's that time of prayer after lunch. And it's
the
where
dead
you're,
hours.
When my students
That's right. We know that teaching during those hours is tough.
We talk, actually, as novices, we talk about that. This is where I first came to the Acadia and read about that. But it was exactly this thing in novice, those times of the day when There are a little bit of options, but how are we going to use that time? And is it going to be productive? Is it going to be work in our heart to bring about conversion and transformation? And we can find 1,000 other things to do. I appreciated your again, I think we often just see it as sloth, it's just laziness, but it's more than that. How can you be freed from it affecting everything? It's almost like this loop that we get into.
Yeah.
Says, oh my gosh, do I have a chance? So how do you
Acadia? Acadia and vainglory are the vices in the tradition that can be everywhere for everything.
Yeah.
Because Acadia, so vainglory, an occasion for vainglory is doing something good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because then you can appreciate the empty glory, how great you are. And Acadia is the same way. You can use good for evil. So every good thing in your life can be at the service of Acadia. I think this is going to something Scott was saying, is that what we need is to not just worry about the superficial or get our checklist of things to do, but what's driving us to do them.
Yeah.
Evagrius has this line where he says, for each thing we do, we should give it a measure to know whether it was a success. And so even though we don't have the same kind of rule of life that they do, we can have, okay, from 1 to 2, I'm going to read this article, or I'm going to write this, or I'm going to do the, and that's the thing that I've set. And so if I fail to do that, I know something bad is going on, unless there's some normal circumstances.
I mean, that's really the deepest meaning of the spiritual life, what some have called an intensity of attention paid to the passing moment, the present moment. You turn it into a sacrament.
Right.
I think that's the late Pope John Paul II was like that. When he met you, it was as if nobody else existed right. on the planet. An intensity of attention. Mm. That's pretty amazing when you consider how many people he had to bump into.
Yeah, it's not just discipline, though.
No.
And that's the thing is, I think it's, in I deal a lot with students in my own life. I mean, this resonates, but if I would just be more disciplined, right. you know, but that's not it.
No, it is. And that can be, I mean, your discipline in one thing can actually be a version of Acadia that I'm just going to work a little harder because then I know I've done enough.
Yeah.
And some of it is the comfort and this idea from Evagrius of setting the limit is then when you're done, you know, you've done enough. You did the thing you were set out to do, and then you're free to do the other thing. Yeah. I mean, the reason we often fill our rest time with busyness is because we filled our busyness with other stuff.
Yeah, I remember when I walked the Camino across Spain, there was one occasion when Father Joe and I, it was a short day, about 12 miles long. And we said, well, let's go 20. Why wouldn't we go 20? Well, that's an idiot, right?
Yeah.
It's that sense that we were doing what we decided we were going to do, but just a little bit more. And I think there's something insidious about this, particularly in the West, that says more is better.
Yeah.
You know, more, if you just do a little bit more, it's better.
There's this idea, and I don't want to say anything terribly controversial, but there's this idea in psychology of good enough parents that actually the bar is pretty low to like do a lot of what your kids need to build healthy attachments and things like that. You don't have to be the best parent in the world to do that. And I like the idea of like a good enough life where it you don't have to be striving for some outrageous ideal in everything if what you've done is overall built in love and health and things like that.
But I mean, the danger with that is it can induce a kind of mediocrity so that you're always at your best.
Yeah, that's right.
And the best is not really the best.
Yeah, no, I there is a danger. And so it's, again, it's a balance, a
potential
balance.
But your reach
balance.
Needs to exceed your grasp.
Right.
I mean, that's magnanimity you aspire.
Right, no, that's right. But also humility is knowing where your limits are
and
being content with those.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's much more for us to discuss, so stay with us.
I start every day by, you know, praying and thanking God for all of the graces that He's bestowed upon me. I'm just, you know, thank Him for the many blessings in my life, you know, the weather, for my schoolwork, for people, just every single person that crossed my path. Thank God for that, and just thankful for everything that, you know, God has just given me.
Walk in the footsteps of saints and martyrs on a Franciscan University pilgrimage. You'll explore the treasures of your Catholic heritage in the Holy Land, Poland, France, Austria, Italy, and more destinations. Find out more at franciscan.edu/pilgrimages.
Back and thanks for joining us. You're watching Franciscan University Presents, which we record here in the ComArts studio at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our students are operating all the cameras. They're taking care of all the equipment. Our theology professors, Dr. Regis Martin and Dr. Scott Hahn, and I are speaking with the philosophy professor, Dr. Brandon Dom, on overcoming the vice of Acadia. How did the Desert Fathers do it? I mean, is it possible?
Well, the Desert Fathers thought you were fighting all the vices your whole life, basically. There wasn't sort of a "and now I've done it," although there were some who seemed to have done it, but the idea was you're going to be fighting.
It's constant.
They're constant, and one of the reasons they're constant is we have needs, and we have needs for food, and if you need food, there's always the danger of gluttony, and if there's a danger of gluttony, there's the danger of all the rest. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't be completely free from at least the need for constant vigilance over them. But the advice of the Desert Fathers on Acadia is one of the reasons I was interested in finding more on it, and their advice was threefold. One was manual labor. The monks worked a lot. They would do things. Even there was one of the famous stories of the desert is a monk who once a year would go burn all the work he had done that year. Because it wasn't about the product, it was about doing the work. And we don't really have a clear analog to that, I think, especially in lots of our professions. The second piece of advice was stability of place. Stay where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And the monks had a very clear idea of where that was, and we need. There is a way we can work on that. And then the third one was just sort of perseverance, like keep at it. The way you find relief is you defeat Acadia. You do the thing you were going to do. Yeah. And Evagrius and Cassian say at that moment there will be a kind of relief and a kind of joy felt.
You soldier on.
Yeah.
As if your perfection lies somehow in the process itself.
That's right. Yeah.
Just keep doing it.
Yeah. Well, you can't fight something with nothing. So you can't fight vice without growing in virtue.
Right.
So you're not just against something, you really are defining yourself in terms of what you're for, and that is holiness. Mm. You know, and that involves so many activities being coordinated, you know.
Right.
But getting first things first, you know, when Jesus says the first and the greatest command is to love the Lord your right. God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then the second is to love your neighbor as right. yourself. And then, surprise, on these two hang all of the law and the prophets.
Yeah.
And so you have the first table of the Decalogue, which is worship the one true God, pray by calling upon his name, but not in vain, and remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But that means working for 6 days, which is mandatory, but resting for the seventh day,
right.
not just for an hour on the Sabbath,
right.
you know, for the Mass or whatever it was yeah. then, but the idea of leisure as giving the rhythm of life, you know, you imagine that for the Desert Fathers, that must have been easier. I hope, you know, it's sort of like Mary Magdalene, the one thing yeah. necessary Mary's done, not Martha. But the idea of leisure, not just once a week, but throughout the day, times of prayer, and especially coordinating prayer with supplication, but also gratitude
right.
and wonder.
Right.
You know, I think that your emphasis upon those two things are sort of what's implied in our Father. If God is our Father, then we're his children. We are like Peter Pigby in your right. article,
yeah.
you know, where we make mountains out of molehills. Actually, we make, you know, I just think that seeing things as small children gives you that sense of wonder, gives you that sense of gratitude, and opens your soul up.
Right.
Could we revisit that schedule that the monks laid yeah. out for the day, the life? I was a little bit dismayed by it because I wasn't sure that they had factored in leisure, that they had made provision for that text in Scripture, be still and know that I am your God.
Right.
Don't work as if you were God. I mean, it somehow sounds a little bit Germanic, as if it had been concocted in Berlin as
right.
opposed to Italy. I mean, there's that wonderful Spanish proverb, nothing is more beautiful than to do nothing and then to rest afterwards. The monks did not appear to be doing that.
No, they didn't have much space for that.
Yeah.
And I think it's a failure. I mean, one of my unpaid side gigs is I'm a volunteer sleep activist. I'm always trying to get students to sleep more.
Yeah.
And they also slept very little, dangerously little. Mm. And so they, I mean, it was clearly a special calling. And so I think
right.
the fact that they were the ones who left everything behind
yeah.
to go. And lots of it was unformed at the time. They just wandered out into the desert
yeah,
looking for holiness.
I think most of us right. would have remained in Alexandria.
Yeah, yeah.
So speak a little bit pots. More to, yeah, the sense of gratitude. And you, it's kind of the culmination where you bring
right.
us to.
So gratitude has three parts. The gracious person sees the world, sees something in having three parts. There's the giver of the gift. There's the gift, which is good. And then there's the receiver.
Yeah.
And so you need to, if you're going to have gratitude, you need to see the world this way. And so my idea was, is that if you're seeing the world this way, you're seeing a good gift from a good giver, you can't be seeing that as empty and hollow and
right.
Painful and difficult. Kids opening their presents on Christmas morning, they don't think, oh, this is a burden. They're running to it. And so if we can cultivate seeing the world that way, then we can fight Acadia through that.
Yeah.
You know, I think envy and Acadia are also culturally institutionalized,
mm.
you know, which is a scary sort of thing because it sows the seeds of resentment
right.
and division and that sort of thing. And so this is applicable, I think, at every level of human life. I also would say that Acadia is something that you need a spiritual director
mm.
to diagnose. I mean, you can read a good article
right.
and read good books, mm-hmm. but I think at least regular confession, frequent confession.
Right.
And, you know, bringing this sort of thing up, especially if you haven't even imagined this as a vice, especially if you're trapped in a kind of professionalitis, as St. Jose Maria called it, workaholism is what
right.
we call it, because you can never do enough for God. And yet, unless you stop and just bask in all that he's done for you,
right.
it's just like a, you know,
yeah, and I think as spiritual director, confessor, accountability, a small faith group, I suppose a spouse, although it may be a little bit too close at times, but somebody that can help walk you through that and say yes, more of that, yes, less of this.
Yeah.
And to be able to share your life.
I mean, somebody who can say, look, let's have a glass of beer together and maybe yeah. throw the frisbee. You need to prayer is really knowing how to waste time prodigiously with God.
Yeah.
The contemplative dimension.
I haven't tried prayer and Frisbee together. I like the combination.
I preferred beer.
But. Yeah. I like this idea a lot. I think one insight of it is that while we need someone to help speak into our lives about when we're suffering from Acadia and also when we're not.
Right.
That Acadia, because
more of that.
Yeah, because it can overrun everything. And so, I mean, especially for our students and our communities, I think we're very happy to see things, places we're failing where we're probably not. Yeah. And that, no, well, sometimes you have done enough.
Well, we live in a world that you know, rewards the 30 hours a day, you know, and,
right.
and that productive. And
that's
it's
right.
like, you know, but then somebody who leaves at work at 4:30. It's, yeah. you know, come on, what are you doing?
You know, Brandon, I was really struck by the opening sentence of your piece, which adverts to the fact that in the ancient world, there didn't seem to be any treatment of Acadia. And it suggested to me that because that world, the world before Christ came to redeem it, was already suffused in sadness, a great weight of ennui hung over that world. It never occurred to them that this is unnatural, this is unhealthy, this is just the structure of the universe. It's not a good thing to be alive. Extinction
right.
is preferable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so Aristotle would disagree with that, which is one of the reasons we like Aristotle, I think.
Yeah.
Aristotle has this very high view of what we're capable of.
Yeah.
And he talks about the virtue of shame. He considers whether it's a virtue. He says, yeah, I guess it's a virtue if you're doing bad things, but not for the virtuous person, because they would do nothing to feel shameful about. And that's not my experience of life, that we're in the struggle. And this is where I think when you're in the struggle but have a high calling, Acadia really manifests.
Right.
You know, I think we tend to assume that the Greco-Roman world was Aristotelian.
Right.
Well, Aristotle was the minority report.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and sadness, ennui, is really the majority experience.
Right.
And, you know, it reminds me of a Chesterton line that, you know, when you try to do without the supernatural, you end up in the unnatural.
Right.
There is no middle zone, you know, where you're just kind of basking in the natural. Yeah, and so before Christ, you're just starved for joy.
Right.
But after Christ, you can end up starving for joy too, more tragically. Perhaps.
Yeah, Chesterton speaks about the gigantic secret of the Christian life, which is joy.
Yeah.
And he describes the ancient world as being tyrannized over by the gods, and they were despotic.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
then he says, behind the gods were the fates. They were deadly. In fact, they were worse than deadly. They were dead. Mm. The dead hand of fate hangs over that world. I mean, they're in the grip of something they can't even identify.
Right.
Like we
If an individual is desirous of growing in a virtue, is it your mind that that impacts all virtues? That if you grow in one, it has kind of this ripple effect that it goes?
So this is a big debate in virtue ethics. It's called the the unity of the virtues thesis,
right.
or the interdependence of the virtues. Aristotle and Aquinas thought they were interdependent in that way. A lot of contemporary virtue ethicists don't think so. And the reason is we see things like a patient thief or a courageous Nazi.
Yeah.
I think Aquinas and Aristotle were more or less right, although it's a difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
But if a virtue is supposed to be something that perfects you, the patience of the thief and the courage of the Nazi actually hurt them. They
right.
damage them. They make them do worse things better. And so I think of it as kind of, this might tell about my childhood, but as a video game.
Mm-hmm.
So in certain video games, you can level up in different characteristics, but you can't, if the virtues are sort of leveling up, you can't level one up very much without having to level the other ones up. Your prudence can only increase so much if your passions are going crazy and you don't have temperance. Your temperance can only get so high if you can't make decisions and you don't have prudence.
Well, if you assume the unity of the human person, then everything
right.
is of a piece. Otherwise, you end up in reductionism.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a specialized
area. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the Christian insight into the four cardinal virtues is such that justitia, justice, which is such a lofty and demanding virtue, has as its highest expression religio.
Hmm.
And that would mean loving God with all of your being, gratitude. I mean, it's not strictly repayable,
right.
but it's not reducible to the supernatural.
No, that's right.
There really is something that is utterly natural and reasonable about loving God as the creator more than myself. And so you get back to the idea of the demands of love. You know, that woman, what's her name again, the ethicist that you quote?
Oh, Rebecca DeYoung.
Yeah, I mean, that was just like a bright light with laser precision.
Oh, that's right.
That so you can have the courageous Nazi, but you don't have an end, you know, right. And it's precisely the ordering of the lower virtues to the highest virtue of justice, but then the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love are what restore that.
Yeah, and so in the natural realm, Aquinas will say it's prudence that unifies the virtues.
Right.
But in the supernatural, it's charity, because charity is what, I mean, it is our friendship with God. It is our relationship with God. And it's that friendship which governs the rest and which unifies everything else.
Yeah.
So how do you help us not feel kind of this weight that this is all around us, we need to wrestle with it? And part of conversion metanoia is this accepting day right. in, day out. Yeah. But one ought not feel this burden or this, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get it right. So how do you speak
to that? So, I mean, I'll speak personally. It's that small steps or a little bit is a lot. Maybe some of us need to walk out of town and into the desert and try and live that life. But for most of us, I mean, I can't do that. My wife would be very unhappy with it. Well, mostly unhappy. And I would be unhappy. I don't want to have their diet. But there's things we can do. I think thinking of perfection as an ideal, as a goal, is worthwhile in lots of ways. But to think of yourself as failing each day because you're not already there, I think is really damaging. Mm-hmm. And so to like take honest stock of where we are, this is the humility side of humility, magnanimity.
Yeah.
Where are we and what's actually possible for me right now? And then the magnanimous side is to strive for what's possible right now with God's help. Yeah. And so there are, I mean, I talk about some of the miracle, but there's little things you can do. Psychologists do, they call them gratitude interventions,
right.
These little practices you can do, and they don't really understand gratitude that well.
Yeah.
But there are things we can do. So each day, if you found a time, you could have a gratitude journal. It's a little cheesy, but each day you write down the three things you're grateful for. You could write letters to the people you're grateful to, even if you don't deliver them, to write that down and express it, to think about what your parents, your friends, your spouse, your children have given you and what you owe them in some sense of what, it's really powerful. It makes you see those things in a different way where day in and day out, you can sort of take them for granted. So there's lots of little things we can do to just practice a little bit.
And I think that's important to take is when I did the Camino again, it seems to be a theme for me today, it was one step at a time. When I signed the book, that's all I do. I say one step at a time that the goal is that's what we're going for, but sometimes it seems so far away, so unbelievably difficult that we almost want to give up.
Right.
We just do it one step at a time.
Great.
Up next, our panel and our guests will give their final thoughts on Acadia, so please stay with us.
I express gratitude mostly just by reflecting my gratefulness on the way I treat other people, knowing that the way that I treat other people should be centered on God's teachings and knowing that there's God in everybody and that it's all His creation. So by showing love for others, I'm showing love for God and gratitude.
When you see the world through a Catholic lens, you see God's hand at work in human history. You see the true, the good, the beautiful. Franciscan University of Steubenville's Master of Arts in Catholic Studies is an online program that offers courses in literature, biology, art, theology, psychology, all taught from a distinctively Catholic perspective so you can see the world with Catholic eyes. Find out more about the Masters in Catholic Studies. Go to franciscan.edu/mcs.
I think it's easy for me to get caught up in my own little world and just staying listening to my headphones all day. So I think it's important to take actionable steps to like take time to not be in my headphones and just receive the gifts that the Lord wants to give me and surprise me with.
Welcome back to Franciscan University Presents. We've come to our final segment. Regis, maybe your final thoughts.
Yeah, gosh, what a splendid article you've written. I'm so grateful. It's marvelous. It makes me wish I had been one of your students in that very philosophy class that midwifed this piece during the COVID season. But I'm not a philosopher, because I'm a theologian. although I respect philosophy, I think it begins in wonder and it eventuates in wisdom, but the wisdom is finally the Word. Mm-hmm. And philosophy can't access him. He can only reveal himself to us. There's a great line in Kant, who is a philosopher, but somebody once said, reading Kant is like swimming through wet sand. It's not recommended. But Kant says that reason has this peculiar fate. It's burdened by questions it has got to ask, but questions it cannot finally answer. Only faith, only revelation can answer them. That's why I think Aquinas is able to complete Aristotle. Mm. And in his commentary on the metaphysics of Aristotle, he asks the question, what is it that unites the poet and the philosopher? And the answer is the marvelous, the capacity to marvel, to take delight, to be astonished by the world. I think that's what's missing. If we could somehow induce that or use it as a contagion to catch our students with it, that passion for being, that avidity for what is real, living the real, then I think they could easily conquer this kind of sloth and achadia that I think increasingly I see them in the grip of. And the first obligation of man is gratitude, thanksgiving for a gift you could never yourself give. And nobody can give himself being, but they can receive it. And that should occasion, I think, a gesture of thanksgiving.
Yeah. And thank you. Final thoughts.
Building on Regis and your article, you speak of gratitude, but also wonder. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of John Senior when he started the Integrated Humanities Program at the University of Kansas. I remember talking to students who came to faith through that program, including the Bishop of Wichita and the Archbishop of Oklahoma City, Bishop of Lincoln, I mean. In any case, they had an assignment, I think it was the first week of the semester, where they had to get some poetry, go out with a friend or two from the class, and the assignment was, I think it also involved some wine, you would read poetry to each other while you're staring up at the stars, and you're just basically restoring wonder. And that was deliberate. I mean, perhaps they got intoxicated too, but that wasn't the purpose. It was really to give these young men and women a sense of wonder and awe at the greatness and the expanse of the universe. And then you would feel small, but you'd also recognize how all of this comes from outside of me, into me. And it sets into motion a number of virtuous actions, or at least it sets into motion the conditions of possibility for that. And I think of, on the other end of things, where I first heard about Acadia was Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture. And just as Acadia is not reducible to sloth, so Acadia is in some ways overcome by leisure, prescribed leisure. 6 days you work, the seventh you rest. It isn't the seventh you get dressed up and you drive off. No, the whole principle of that Sabbath is resting. And it's not just you, it's your sons and daughters, maidservants and men, even the sojourners, because they're all God's children. They all need to have that time for wonder and gratitude and worship. And it's like, this isn't rocket science, but it's not simply keeping a checklist of the Ten Commandments. It really has to do with seeing in Jesus the embodiment of virtue. And I just think that at the end of the day, Christ has made it possible for weaklings like me to find the road to sanctity and just keep my eyes on his face and study his life in the Gospels. And I think Aristotle would be, wherever he is, saying, yeah, I wish I had him.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Scott. Final thoughts?
Yeah, so speaking of gratitude, thanks again for having me. It's been great talking to you all, and thanks for reading the article. I just want to say, I think, three quick things, because triples is best. So first is, some people might feel like people can't change and that it's difficult. And I just want to go back to what we were talking about, that this is a kind of just to try something. Try something small even. There's not going to be perfection in a day, but it's difficult and life is hard and life can sort of suck the energy out of it seeming possible. But there's little things we can do that can have big effects over time. I think the second thing is to sort of, so that was the magnanimity side. The humility side is, while we need to take the moral life very seriously, and Acadia is really serious, I think it's also helpful to not take ourselves quite so seriously. Mm-hmm. And so Acadia makes us do really silly things, like clean our office when we're supposed to be doing other things, or just it's in some ways kind of a silly vice. And I think laughing at ourselves can be really helpful. Yeah. To sort of step back and realize how silly it is for me to be making this big struggle of just putting words onto paper. Mm-hmm. It's not that I can do it, put a little bit of effort in and laugh. And that helps. When we laugh at ourselves, we see, I think, our position, our relationship to this thing and to God. And that's the last thing, is this humble side. And the Desert Fathers thought humility was the sort of architectonic virtue, that everything relied on it. And so getting our relationship right with God and seeing ourselves clearly helps build everything else, and laughing at ourselves can help with that.
Amen. That's fantastic. If you'd like to learn more about today's topic, we have a free handout, a short summary by Dr. Brandon Dom. On our discussion today on Acadia, it's yours for free. Just go on faithandreason.com/presents or call the number that we'll provide momentarily. I appreciated this. I'm in the midst of a project that's about a 3-month project, and this came at the perfect time because it's amazing the things that I've been found. A couple of thoughts that went through my mind is using Jesus as an example. I'm always touched by Jesus would be in a situation and he was attentive to what was being asked of him at that time. And he probably did that. You mentioned that John Paul did that well. My suspicion is that Jesus did that perfectly. Yeah. And so it caused me to reflect. I first heard this Acadia as a novice. And in the line we always said, if you keep the rule will keep you. Mm-hmm. And the point is this, live the life, do what you're supposed to do. And then St. Francis's line to his brothers where he said, I have done what is mine. Mm-hmm. May the Lord show you what is yours, right? So that's what I want, is to just to be able to do what is before me, what the Lord has for me. The famous quote, I don't know who did it, who said, is that purgatory is full of people who did more than God asked them to, right? Is what is it that Jesus is asking of us? What are the tasks that need to be done? I so appreciate your just little things, just check them off, a sense of victory, a sense of accomplishment that moves in your heart that says, okay, this is possible, that I can do this. And I think you just present just a wonderful path forward. That it's a very serious topic, it's very serious vice, but it doesn't have to consume us. Right. You know, that there is power, there is grace, mm-hmm. the Spirit really can help us overcome it. So thank you so much for your article. Let's just ask the Lord's blessing. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift that is your grace and your mercy, your Holy Spirit that helps us. We pray that you would free us from vice, lead us deeper in a relationship with you. We pray for the person, individual right now who feels burdened, overcome, too many things to be done, a burden, a cross that they have to carry. Free them from that, Lord. Let them know your love and your peace. We ask your blessing to be upon them, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Thank you so much. God bless you. Have a good day.
Download a free handout on today's topic at faithandreason.com/presents. You can also watch past episodes of Franciscan University Presents, or request the handout by emailing us at presents@franciscan.edu. Or reach us by phone for today's handout by calling 800-783-6447. That's 800-783-6447.